Rory, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Tell us about your family who are still in South Africa at the moment.
Well, I have a wife who's a school teacher. Her name's Jill, and we have three boys, 18, 16, and 10, and they're just about to start their final school exams. I need to get home because my eldest is writing his matric or his grade 12 finals now, so it's a good time to be back. Yeah,
that's terrific. And you, where do you live?
I live in Joburg. I was born in Cape Town, in the land of milk and honey, but my youngest brother was born with quite a serious lung problem, and the doctors told my parents to get up to Joburg onto the Highveld because the Joburg sits at about 1,600 meters or 5,500 feet altitude, where the air is much thinner and much drier, and that was good for a child born with a lung problem. And once you get up there to the big smoke, to the commercial area, then you very rarely go back. So I'm Cape Town born and Joburg bred.
And Joburg is the center of the universe, is that right?
Absolutely.
I love it. Yeah. I love coastal cities, I love to surf, but when I get to Joburg, I really feel like it's a second home. I love that landlocked city. Rory, you were born in 1963. Apartheid as an ideology, a racist ideology, had infiltrated every area of South African life by 1963. They'd had 15 years to lay down this ideology so that it affected the government, the education, every area of society. You're born in 63, you go to school in the 70s and early 80s. Just before we ask you what that was like, we're going to show a clip from a movie called Cry the Beloved Country. Can you tell us what it was like as a white South African child, English speaking, growing up in this culture?
Well, as I always say, I'll try my best. I do appreciate that most of you, if you're not South African, you might not understand what it was like when I say that when I was born in 1963, apartheid, as David said, it had 15 years to establish itself. But you grow up into whatever the situation is at the time, and you just accept that as normal. And that's the part that might be difficult to understand for you, but that's the only way I can tell it, because that's how it was. So what that meant was we have, all of us in South Africa, have wonderful African ladies who work in our homes and who help bring up our children. They are the nannies to our kids. They clean our homes. And it's a wonderful, privileged lifestyle that we lead in South Africa. There's no doubt about that. And you end up as a young kid of two or three, you play with your nanny's kids, and then you reach the age of six, and you go to that school, and they go to that school. So when I went to school from about 1969 or 1970, I only went to school with white children, and I didn't think anything of that. That's just the way it was. You don't start to reflect on things in life as a six-year-old. Reflection comes much later as you become an adult. And maybe I was a little bit slow, but I didn't, like many other white people, start to question this. I just went with it. It was what it was. And that's the South Africa that I grew up into. Right now, as I told you, my wife's a school teacher. Our schools back home are integrated now. My kids have got friends from many different races and cultures, and they go to school with them. They play sport with them. It's not an issue. My little 10-year-old, when he was about four, he went to a party that one of his classmates invited him to, but it was a little black kid. And he came back from the party, he ran into the house, and the first thing he said to my wife and I, he said, "Mom, Dad, Tato's parents are black." Because the kids don't see skin color. You know, just like I didn't see that there was anything wrong with going to a school where the only people in my class were white. It's just the way it is.
Rory, you leave school in the early 80s. You go into the police service in 1982. And that is about the time that you take seriously the claims of Jesus on your life. Can you describe that for us?
Sure. So when I finished matric, or grade 12, in 1981, every white South African male had to go to the army for 2 years. There was compulsory national service. You did 6 months of basic training, which was quite interesting because you got chased around by a corporal with hair shorter than mine and an IQ the same as his shoe size. And then you were deployed. You either got deployed to our borders, where we fought a kind of a guerrilla warfare because the liberation movements were trying to infiltrate armed personnel into the country, or you went to the townships, saw some of the scenes there where there was often conflict there with the police, and sometimes they sent the troops in there. But for 2 years, you had to serve. And I didn't think that was really what I needed to do. So I thought, instead of joining the army for 2 years, compulsory military service, I would join the police force, because if you joined the police force and gave them 4 years, then you could study, or I could study a law degree, because I did not have the marks in matric to earn a bursary or a scholarship to university. And my parents, my dad certainly didn't have the money to send me to university. My dad was a journalist all his life. He was a single parent and there was not a lot of money around. So I thought, let's go and join the police and they can pay for my studies. And after 4 years, I'll have a degree and I will not owe the army the 2 years that I really didn't want to go and do in the first place. So that's what I did.
So Rory, the years move on and you marry Jill. And in 1990, when de Klerk unbans these illegal political parties, you're a lieutenant in the security branch in Johannesburg. Can you describe for us what the security branch did?
Sure. I'm sorry, I forgot to actually answer your question. I think you asked me about meeting Jesus.
Yes.
Okay, he did. Okay, so I was starting to set the scene and give you some context when I became sidetracked, so I do apologize. So my dad knows that I've got to go off to police college for 1 year's police training as an 18-year-old, fresh out of school. He also knew that I, as an English-speaking South African, would be in the minority, because not a lot of English-speaking boys went to the police force in those days. The police force was almost solely the preserve of Afrikaans-speaking males. And my dad knew that I would be a little isolated. He was right. In my platoon 7 of Bravo Company, 1981, there were 2 English-speaking kids out of 36 men in there for training. So he was right. So he gives me this book called Learning and Living the Christian Life by John Blanchard. John Blanchard was an English evangelist. And he said, read some of this book every day. Now, when I was 15, 16 years old, I went to our youth group at church. I went on youth camps, scripture union camps, and so on. But to be honest, I didn't take it very seriously. And I was kind of dabbling with Christianity. You see, my father had become a Christian when I was about 13. And he tried very hard to play catch up and to input into our young lives. I'm the eldest of 3 boys. He tried to kind of put in what he hadn't done for the last 13 years of my life. So he sent us to these things. But as I said, I didn't really take it seriously. I figured, man, there's life to be lived and fun to be had and a time to be enjoyed. You know, that stuff about God and making a commitment can come later after I've had my fun, which is just stupid thinking. But I didn't know it then as an equally stupid 15 or 16-year-old. So my dad gives me this book. Every night I read a bit of the book and I read a bit of my Bible because my dad asked me to, right? So I get to, at some stage during that year of training in 1982 in the police college in Pretoria, I get to Psalm 2 where King David writes, "Today I have become your son, today you have become my father." And I said, "All right, Lord, it's time to take this stuff seriously." Because I knew what I had to do, but I was putting it off. So I made a commitment to follow Jesus. And I'm still following him today. As Dave says, I met my wife that same year. We got married a few years later, and we started a family 6 years after that. So my eldest son, the one who's writing his matric finals now, was born in January of 1994. And President Mandela became president of our country in April actually May of 1994. So when I see the stupid things that our politicians say and do right now in our country, I'm very often reminded that our country is a bit like an 18-year-old teenager. We're still growing up. We've still got those fluctuations of emotions and hormonal influences and that kind of thing. So, you know, I get very cross when I see these guys stealing money and, you know, doing these stupid things. And then I think, okay, cut them some slack. They're still going to go to jail, but they are, after all, behaving like an 18-year-old teenager.
And so, Rory, 1990, you're in the special branch. Describe what the special branch specialized in.
Well, the special branch of the South African Police Force specialized in anything that was considered to be a political crime. Now, I'm very sure that you in Australia have a special branch in your police service. There's nothing wrong with that. And I'm pretty sure that your special branch in Australia concentrates on things like the threat that terror poses to Australian national security. That's what special branches do. But in my day, the special branch, as I said, concentrated on political crime. And what was that? Well, organizations like the political party that President Mandela was the head of, which is the African National Congress, or the ANC, the South African Communist Party, and other organizations, they were banned organizations in South Africa. So you were not allowed to further the aims of any of those organizations, because if you did, you were committing a crime and you could go to jail, just like the president did. And our job was to monitor the activists who were members of, or so-called members of, those organizations, because you weren't even allowed to be a member of those organizations. That too was a crime. So that was our job as the security branch.
Rory, Mandela is released after the ANC is unbanned in 1990. He becomes president in 1994. We're now going to see just again a short clip out of the movie Invictus to help us understand what is going on in South Africa from Mandela's release to his inauguration. Rory, leading up to those elections, you were fairly doubtful whether Nelson Mandela was a genuine person. You just thought it was all political propaganda. What happened between 1990 and 1994, that very dangerous period in South Africa's history, that demonstrated to you and to others that he was a genuine statesman who wanted peace and prosperity for his nation?
Well, nothing happened during that period that convinced me of that. I didn't believe for 1 minute the stuff he was saying when the president came out of prison. Remember who I was. I was a white security branch cop. We were trained in the ideology of the ANC because the ANC was our enemy, and you've got to understand the strategy of your enemy. So when he came out of jail, and the final scene of that video clip where you see the young youth running through the streets, they are on their way to the Grand Parade in Cape Town, because the day that Mandela was released from prison, 11th of February 1990, was the day that he went to make his first speech in public after being incarcerated for 27 years. So you can imagine what a big thing that was. The entire world's media was in South Africa, in Cape Town, to hear what he was going to say. We didn't even know what he looked like, because under the censorship laws that existed in South Africa under apartheid, you weren't allowed to publish the picture, the photograph, the painting, all the statements or sayings or writings of any convicted political criminal. So for 27 years, we kind of imagined what he looked like. We knew what he looked like before he went in, but 27 years is a long time, and a man can age in 27 years. So he comes out of jail and goes to the Grand Parade that day, and he stands up there with a huge crowd of people in there celebrating. And he says, "South Africa is for all her people, both black and white." And he's quoting from a document called the Freedom Charter, which was drawn up in 1955 in Kliptown in Soweto by a bunch of community organizations, including the ANC and the Pan-Africanist Congress and others. And that document actually now forms the basis for our constitution. And I, as the cynical white cop, am listening to this, South Africa is for all her people, black and white, blah, 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 and I'm going, of course you're going to say that. That's the ANC party line. That's just rhetoric and propaganda, and I did not believe it.
Rory, what happened in 1993, just a year before those first elections?
Okay, well, this I came to learn about after I eventually came to head President Mandela's protection detail, because the black guys that protected him between him coming out of prison and becoming president told me this story. So in 1993, the ANC is preparing for the election campaign that would ultimately elect Mandela as president of our country. And they were fundraising quite extensively abroad, getting in donations to help them run a campaign, an election campaign, something that they'd never done before. And it was a Sunday, sometime in 93, well, it must have been in May. It must have been in May of 1993 because I know where I was. I was in Switzerland. My wife and I had been married for a few years. We saved up every last cent that we could, and we didn't have very much because I was a cop and she was a teacher. And for some reason, teachers and policemen and nurses don't get paid very well, and they're the most important people in the whole country. But be that as it may, they're way more important than politicians, by the way. So we're in Switzerland, and my wife, Jill, phones her dad back home in South Africa from a payphone in Interlaken on this particular Sunday. And her father tells her, whatever you do, stay where you are and don't come back home. This place could possibly go up in flames. And he wasn't exaggerating. What had happened was a young black political leader called Chris Hani had been murdered in his driveway on a Sunday morning after he had just gone around the corner to go and buy the Sunday newspapers. He'd been murdered by two white right-wingers. And how crazy is this? They had planned to assassinate him, so they went on a Sunday morning to go and see where he lived because they had the address, but they didn't know what it looked like there. So they were actually doing a reconnaissance. And they saw, but here he is, and he was driving in there all on his own, nobody with him, no security detail, no bodyguards. So now's a good time, right? So they just shot him dead in cold blood in his driveway as he came in with the newspapers under his arm. And the black youth of our country went absolutely berserk. And they took to the streets looking for revenge, wanting blood, and basically wanting to burn the place down. So this is why my father-in-law told his daughter to stay in Switzerland. President Mandela obviously gets to hear about this within minutes because the phone lines light up and the message spreads that Chris Hani has been assassinated. Madiba has just got back from one of those fundraising trips and he's tired from his travels. But he says to his security detail, take me to the SABC now. So they get in the car and they drive. It's not a long drive from Houghton to Auckland Park where the SABC is. He goes on live television and live radio, every station and channel across our country, and he appeals to the black youth. He says, we understand your anger, but I don't want you to get onto the streets seeking revenge and seeking blood because that's not going to achieve anything. He said, by the way, two people have been arrested for this murder, and the lady who phoned the police and reported it is a white Afrikaans-speaking woman who lived across the road from Chris Hani. And she wrote down the registration number and phoned the police, and they've got these guys in custody. Please wait until justice takes its course. Which to me was an extraordinary act of leadership. I mean, he wasn't even president yet. This is 93. And that managed to somehow keep the lid on this pressure cooker that was about to go off and set our country on a path to civil war. And it was very, very close.
Rory, in 1994, when Mandela comes to power, you are now in charge of VIP protection in the Johannesburg area. The inauguration is taking place up at Pretoria, 60 kilometres up the road. What happens that day that you witness that changes your mind about Nelson Mandela?
Okay, good question. Just a step back. How did I come to be head of VIP protection in Johannesburg? Well, very simply, That footage that you saw just now was the genuine footage. That was actually then State President F.W. de Klerk there. That wasn't an actor. And that's him announcing at the opening of Parliament on the 2nd of February 1990, he announces to South Africans and to the world that he's going to release Mandela and he's going to unban the banned organizations. Now, State President de Klerk did not prepare his generals for that he was going to say that. He must have told maybe his close cabinet aides, but he didn't tell us. And we're sitting in the office. I mean, who really watches a speech at the opening of Parliament? Not many people, but you've kind of got, you've got half an eye on it as you go about your work. And he stands up there and he makes this incredible statement that literally changes history. By the way, F.W. de Klerk was awarded the Nobel Prize for Peace in 93 alongside President Mandela. So the two South African leaders, one black, one white, were awarded the Peace Prize that year. It was an extraordinary step. And at the stroke of a pen, literally at the stroke of a pen, as the state president signed the unbanning of those organizations into law, we, as the security branch, no longer had a job. Because all our suspects and all our clients are no longer illegal organizations, they're now legal. So what are we going to do now? Excuse me. So they took this young, very green, very wet behind the ears lieutenant, and they said, Steyn, you can head up the VIP unit. And I got all these old warrant officers nearing the end of their careers reporting to me. And I don't know what they thought of this young kid that they had to report to. But that's what happened. And I became head of VIP protection. President de Klerk lived in the official residence, which is in Pretoria, which is 60 kilometers north of Johannesburg. And he didn't come to Joburg very often, maybe half a dozen times a year. And he hated security. Because his predecessors were John Forster and P.W. Botha. One was Minister of Police, the other Minister of Defense. And he wanted to break with that mold of South African prime ministers and state presidents being former securocrats. So he didn't want to see policemen and police cars and police dogs at the venues where he was. And I was the commander of the VIP unit. So if the state president came to my town, I went myself and I oversaw the security arrangements at whatever venue he was going to be attending at. So if he was here today addressing you, I would come, bring the sniffer dogs and the bomb unit, and we would clean, sterilize the place, make sure there's nothing funny here, and we would post cops at the doors so that we can control the access, and then the protection team will bring the president in there. But it was done very under the radar, very quietly and very discreetly, because the state president did not like security. Now comes 1994. And we've all of a sudden got a new president in office. This new president has both a home and an office in Johannesburg, in my town. So instead of going half a dozen times a year and securing the venues where the president's going, I'm doing it half a dozen times a day because he lives there. And on his inauguration day, President Mandela was inaugurated at that ceremony that you saw there where it was Morgan Freeman standing with his hand up playing Madiba. Somebody very smart on the organizing committee of the inauguration proceedings decided that we would play a soccer match at Ellis Park in Johannesburg on inauguration day. Why? Because they were expecting massive crowds to go to the union buildings in Pretoria, and they were worried about those lawns being overcrowded by hundreds of thousands of people there. There were over 100,000 people on those lawns that day, so it was a very smart thing to do. So they put 60,000 people into Ellis Park, televised the inauguration ceremony on the big screen in the stadium, and that was 60,000 fewer people who would try and get up the M1 and make the traffic worse and overcrowd those lawns by a further 60,000. So good thinking. South Africa that day played Zambia in the soccer match, which has now since become an annual event. It's called, unsurprisingly, the Nelson Mandela Inauguration Challenge. And we've played the greatest teams in the world, like Brazil and Argentina, England, Cote d'Ivoire, and many other nations. We've played them in this fixture since 1994. But here I am as the commander of the VIP unit, and I'm thinking, well, you know, if this was yesterday and it was de Klerk coming, I would go and secure the president's suite at the stadium. I better go. even though we've got a different president there. And let me just tell you an interesting story about that. I had several senior black police officers reporting to me on my unit. And in about February of 1994, these guys came to my office one day on the 7th floor of John Forster Square in the security branch. And they knocked on my door and they said, "Major, can we see you?" I said, "Guys, come in, sit down. What's the problem?" They said, "Look, we are concerned because we don't know what's going to happen to us as black police officers in the security branch if the ANC win the election and come to power." And their fears were completely justified, ladies and gentlemen, because any black collaborator with the apartheid system was dealt with in unbelievably harsh ways. The Zulu have a word for this. If you a spy in the Zulu language is called an impimpi. So izimpimpi were dealt with harshly if they collaborated with the apartheid regime. Some of the ways that they were dealt with was put a tire around the guy's neck, fill it with petrol, and set it alight. And I'm not joking, that was called a necklace. And people died this horrific death like that if they were considered to be collaborators with this apartheid regime. So I said to them, "Guys, I don't have the answer to that question, but I'm going to try and find out for you." So I phoned my boss in Pretoria, the head of VIP protection in the police. I said, "Colonel, I've just had this conversation with my black officers." He starts shouting at me over the phone from Pretoria. If I put the phone down on the desk, I probably would have heard him shouting at me from 60 Ks up the highway. He says, "These things are being deliberated at a senior level, and you will be informed once we know what's going to happen after the election." Today is the 3rd of November, 2012. I'm still waiting to be informed by Pretoria about what happened.
Rory, I want to assure you and everybody that Ray Galeers brought the sniffer dogs through and he sanitised the area, and so we're completely safe here today. Can you tell me about this soccer match on Inauguration Day and what you saw?
Well, I was getting there, yes. So I go to Ellis Park, not having received my instructions from Pretoria. I just figured it out for myself that I'm still the commander of the VIP unit. I'm going to go and do what I do. So I went to Ellis Park, and we swept the president's suite with the sniffer dogs, and we secured the venue. And President Mandela has now just put his hand up and sworn the oath of allegiance, and he gets in a helicopter, and they fly him, the Air Force fly him from Pretoria to Johannesburg, and he lands at the Technicon building, which is right next door to Ellis Park, put him into some cars and drive him around the corner, up a vehicle ramp, into a huge, big reception hall that's behind the president's suite at the stadium. He gets out of the car, gets in the lift, and goes down to the field level, walks out of the tunnel at halftime. He was supposed to arrive before the match kicked off and do what presidents do and greet the teams on the field. But things ran a little bit late in Pretoria, and that was not his fault, because President Mandela was never late for anything. He was the most punctual VIP I've ever had the privilege of working with, and it wasn't his fault that we only arrived at halftime. So he comes out of the tunnel. The score is 0-0 in the match. He shakes hands. He goes back up the tunnel, back up the lift, gets into the president's suite 2 or 3 minutes later, and the score is 2-0 to South Africa. So that was a proper halftime team talk. And he then makes his apologies. He says, "Guys, I've got to get back to Pretoria and host a lunch for all of these dignitaries that have attended my inauguration." There were 184 visiting heads of state there. And he gets into the vehicle, and they're about to drive across the floor of the reception hall and out back to the helicopter when the security guys see the president trying to open the door of this car, which you and I might think is an easy thing to do, but not when it's a 3.8-ton armored vehicle. You can't just open the door from the inside very easily, especially if you're in your late 70s. So the ANC security guys call their man in the car and say, "Mandla, why does he want to get out of the car?" Mandla says, "I don't know." So they open the door. President gets out of the car. And remember, he's late. Gets out of the car, doesn't say a word to any of us standing there. And he starts walking across this reception hall. It was exactly the same size as this room that we're in. And over there where those doors are is the ramp going down that the vehicle should have driven out of to take him back to the helicopter. And the only person who's standing there against the wall is an old school white police colonel in full uniform with his stars on his shoulders and his scrambled eggs on his cap caviar. And his eyes are getting bigger and bigger and bigger as the president's walking towards him because he's thinking, why is he coming to me? And Madiba walks up to him, stops in front of him and puts out his hand and says to him, Colonel, today you have become our police. And there's no more you and us. I'm now the president of this country. But I want you to know that today you are now our police. And my friends, this old school police colonel from the old South Africa started crying. And the tears were running down the lines on this face that had seen it all and done it all and been there. And they were dripping onto the wooden floor like this. And the president just tapped him on the shoulder and said, it's okay, Colonel. I just wanted to tell you that myself. And he turned on his heel and went back to his car. And there were about 10 of us standing there with our mouths hanging open. Pardon me, because we could not believe what we'd just seen. And what it said to me as this very cynical white cop was, you know what, those 184 heads of state that I'm about to have lunch with, they can wait. Because I need to tell this guy this message myself today. And that had a huge effect on me. As I try to explain to you, this ideology that was the ideology of the day under apartheid, that thing permeated every level of our society. It affected the history that we were taught in our schools. It affected the media that was transmitted over our airwaves. It affected the church. And I was 32 years old at the time on Inauguration Day, the 10th of May, 1994, when I witnessed this exchange between the president and the colonel. And that was the day I started to question 32 years of conditioning. And I started to think, man, have we been wrong believing this stuff? Have I been wrong thinking that what Mandela is saying is just a facade? It's just political rhetoric. It's the party line. Have I maybe been wrong? And I started to think that day, and it didn't take very much longer, maybe 2 or 3 months after that, to witness this kind of thing. I knew that I'd been wrong.
So, Rory, you became a Christian when you were about 18, and you enjoyed the forgiveness and grace of Jesus Christ. You treasured his death and resurrection for you, but there was still a lot of work that Jesus had to do in your life because there were still these racist tendencies. And as you were challenged by this example of the Madiba, though some of those racist tendencies were being dealt with. What I'd like to do now is just have another video clip. This gives Rory just a chance to have a break too. And this will again show us of the generosity and the kindness and the way in which Mandela was able to embrace all South Africans. Can you tell us whether that is accurate? What actually happened and what did Mandela say? And can you tell us what he did that afternoon?
Sure, that is entirely accurate. Although that's a very poor it's a very poor record of what actually happened, because the room that they were in wasn't just a boring old office there. It was actually the cabinet room in the union buildings. And what had happened was this. When Madiba became president, he included F.W. de Klerk in the government of national unity and made him an executive deputy president. There were two. There was Thabo Mbeki, who succeeded him as president, and there was F.W. de Klerk, who was the second deputy president. And his party, the old National Party, had 6 cabinet positions in the new cabinet. So it was a government of national unity, and there were others. So Mr. de Klerk was now state president, and he was previously state president and he's now executive deputy president. So he only took his close aides and a very small core of his office team to this new office that needed to be created of deputy president. And that left the whole civil service who were attached to the office of the president, left them behind. And in no other African country where there has been a transition from a colonial power to a local government, has the local government not come in and completely swept all the colonialists out of there? And we were expecting exactly the same thing to happen in South Africa. It was a completely legitimate expectation. That's why you heard those two white guys saying at the door, here he comes, he wants the satisfaction of firing us himself. That's what we all thought would happen. And these murmurings in the corridors of the union buildings had got to the ears of the president through his director general. So he told the director general, assemble everybody in the cabinet room. And the cabinet room is a very imposing edifice. It's got steeply raked wood paneled desks that are set around it in a semicircle. So when cabinet's in session, the cabinet ministers sit at the desks at the top and the deputy ministers at the bottom, and it's quite an intense environment. And they're in that intense space when this speech happens. And that's exactly what he said. He said, if you don't see your way clear to work with us as the new government, then please leave. We'll give you a pension and you can retire and you can move on with your lives. But if you do see your way clear and you would like to contribute to building a new nation, then I'm telling you today that we need you. And he said in so many words, he said, some of our people come from the bush. They don't know how to run a country. We need your help. And I think more than 95% of them stayed behind and helped to run the country and to build South Africa into what it is today. And I consider that to be an extraordinary act of both leadership and of forgiveness from Madiba. And that actually happened.
Rory, what happened that afternoon? What did you then do?
Oh, sorry, yeah. So the rest of the day, that happened first thing in the morning. As everybody came to work, they were shuttled into the cabinet room. The president spent the rest of that day going from office to office to office in the union buildings and introducing himself to all of these staff, predominantly white, predominantly Afrikaans-speaking staff. And I had tea with one of the senior staff members there who was in charge of the government vehicles in the office of the president. She was a spinster. She'd never married, and she was a real old-school civil servant, man. The type of person who taught, who considered government property to be her own property. You know, you try and get a set of car keys from her, you better have a good reason. Because she's not releasing that car to you, you know, because it's government property. And I had a cup of tea in her office, and she said to me, you know, Rory, I've served three presidents. I've served P.W. Botha, I've served F.W. de Klerk, and neither of them ever walked into my office and asked me what my name was. But Madiba did. And that was just the kind of thing that he would do. And I heard about this. I was not there that day, but I heard about it from the colleagues of mine, like those two guys in the movie clip who were there.
Rory, I just want to reassure you as you go home that our politicians don't come from the bush. They come from the city, and they can't run a country either.
We've got a few of those now, yeah.
Rory, we're going to show a final clip, and this is just showing us the tension that existed between the bodyguards. And so we'll just watch this last clip, and then I've got a couple more questions for you. Rory, you were deeply in the heart of these bodyguards, these teams of bodyguards, black and white bodyguards, starting with great tension. And it was that kind of attitude by Mandela that began to permeate through the entire bodyguard unit. I want to fast forward now to a time when you're leading VIP protection and Nelson Mandela's protection in particular, and you go on a state visit to London, and your black and white bodyguard team are with you on that state visit. I'm really interested in knowing whether there was a time when you had to evacuate the president, when you had to be a human shield for the president. Can you describe this time in Brixton in London for us?
Sure. So this is how it works. If your head of state comes to my country, then we as the host country are responsible for the safety of your principal. But we've got to recognize that when your head of state comes to my country, he or she comes with a protection detail that work with him or her 9 to 5 every other day of the year. And furthermore, I will come to your country one day. So there's this understanding that we treat each other and we acknowledge each other's roles because one hand washes the other. So we go to London in July of 1996 on a state visit, and President Mandela specifically requests to go to Brixton. Now, you would appreciate that Brixton probably isn't on your average tour of duty of heads of state who visit London. But because of its history and because of the fact that it's a predominantly black ethnic community, and President Mandela is, just trust me on this, he is a kind of a messiah to any black community anywhere in the world. So they were absolutely delighted to hear that he was coming to Brixton. So what were we going to do in Brixton? Well, he had to open a community center that was built there by a charity headed by Prince Charles. So after the ribbon was cut and the kids had had the activities, we would come out of this community center, walk down the stairs and into the main road where the Bobbies had erected crowd barriers down either side of the road, and the people of Brixton could come in their thousands to see this man for them, who was some kind of a messiah, as I've said. And they came in their thousands, and they were smashed up against these crowd barriers, 10, 15 people deep. And when we walked out of that community center, I just knew that something was gonna go down today, because the hairs on the back of my neck stood up and every sense of mine switched on, and I knew today will be the day that we've got to do something. I don't know why, it just was like that. On our left here, as we come down the staircase, are all the vehicles that we've arrived in. There is the Rolls Royce that the Queen gave the President. There's a black special branch follow car that I'm traveling in behind that. Prince Charles has got his armored Jaguar and its black special branch, actually Royalty Protection Unit Rover, behind it. And there's a big 44-seater luxury bus that brings the whole delegation that accompanies a state visit, because a state visit doesn't just happen. You have a lot of these people that come with it. Now, the idea is that we'll walk down the stairs, turn right, and walk 100 meters down the road in order to give the people a chance to see the President. And only the President and Prince Charles are supposed to walk in the road. And my concern was that everybody else must just go to their cars, because if we've got to move him out of there, I don't want to be delayed by people who are not in the place where they're supposed to be. Because we'll make sure that he's where he's supposed to be, but we haven't got enough manpower to worry about all of them. So I tell this to one of the palace aides who's standing next to me on the landing as we walk out of the community center. He's a lieutenant colonel, a retired lieutenant colonel from the British Army, Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Mather. I said to him, Colonel, please could you just ensure that that delegation goes to the bus, because we haven't got the manpower here to be concerned about them. We're here for the President. And he said something to me along the lines of, young man, we've been doing this for hundreds of years. I said, okay, Colonel, I get it, but please make sure the delegation goes to the bus. So Madiba walks down the stairs with Prince Charles next to him. They turn right and start walking down the road. He's waving at the crowds, and we as the protection detail have given him a lot of space, very loose formation. He's here so the people can see him, right? Well, where do you think the delegation went? To the bus? So this snake of humanity follows him down the road. And the people of Brixton standing on the other side of the crowd barrier look at these guys. They don't know who they are. They don't know that that one's a cabinet minister and that one's a CEO of a multinational global corporation. So they think, well, if they're in the road, let's join them. And they start to jump over the crowd barriers. The British Bobbies were doing a fine job. They were facing the crowd. They weren't watching the President. They were doing what they were supposed to do. But let me tell you that 1, 2, and 3, you might catch them when they jump, but 4, 5, 6, and the rest, they're in the road before you know it, and they're now running towards my President. I don't know what they wanted to do. Hug him? Show him love? I don't know, man, but they were coming, and they were coming fast. So we now had to zip our little loose formation in very tightly, and we were literally manhandling these guys, pushing them away, holding them back, bumping the odd one hard with a shoulder, saying, stay away. And I said to him, we're going to have to evacuate, Mr. President. Now, let me rewind this movie 2 months. In May of 1996, we went there to plan the state visit. Because I've already told you, you don't just show up at Buckingham Palace and have a state visit. There's a lot of planning that goes into this. So I get to understand that the person who will drive this Rolls Royce that the President is traveling in won't be a highly trained special branch cop, anti-ambush, anti-hijack, advanced driving skills course driver. It's going to be some driver from the Royal Mews in the palace. When I get to meet the guy 2 months later, when we get there for the state visit, the dude is 90 years old in the shade, man. I said to these palms, what are you doing? Why do you want to give me somebody who's the same age as the president? You know, I don't need that. I need somebody who knows what he's doing in this car behind the wheels here. They said, don't worry, he's the one who knows the car best and all of that rubbish, which I thought was a pretty weak reason. So now I'm standing in the road in Brixton and I've got mayhem developing all around me and I need to put my president into something if we're going to evacuate him, so I need the car. Where do you think my wrinkly 90-year-old driver was? He was right there where I needed him. When I turned around, I just saw that bonnet and that shiny radiator on that Rolls Royce, and I knew we were okay. By the way, he was the only one who got a car through that mayhem that we had left behind there. My special branch Rover with my highly trained cop, anti-ambush, hijacked, whatever, driving, nowhere. Prince Charles's Jaguar and his Rover, nowhere. The bus, forget about it. It's a bus. You're not going to get it through the crowd. The only thing that started to get free there was the team of police motorcycles that escort heads of state on state visits. Because what they do in London is that they have 12 of them, and they put the first two or three or four into the first two or three or four intersections. The Rolls-Royce drives through the intersections that they've closed, and then the ones behind leapfrog past their colleagues to the next three or four intersections. And it's like a rolling roadblock that goes through the streets of London. And we put the president in the Rolls, and I say to Prince Charles's protection officer, listen, you better put him in the Rolls as well because your car's nowhere. So they put Prince Charles in the wrong car. I look for the president's daughter who was accompanying him. I just saw these big eyes and arms and legs flailing back there. I shouted to one of the bobbies, push her forward. That's the president's daughter. So they pushed her. We put her in the car now. She hasn't got a seat anymore because Prince Charles is sitting in her seat. But she's in the Rolls. And we start to move this car forward very slowly, aided only by the police horses that the bobbies brought in there. You know those horses that I'm talking about? Highly trained cop horses. They've got Perspex blinkers over their eyes because pommies can't behave at soccer matches. You know? They bring those horses in next to the car, and what they do is they wiggle in there between the car and the crowd, and they just bump with their rumps. And the people move, boy, because if you don't move, you go down, or you get stood on by those high-stepping feet as the horse comes in there. They stood on me, they stood on my colleagues, but they got the people away from the car. Because can you believe it? These people from Brixton that are in the road now are now trying to open the door of the Rolls. Why? I don't know. Maybe they want to get in there to give the president a hug. But we're not going to allow that, so we're still pushing them away from the door. You know, a little more harshly now. We're throwing the odd one away who doesn't want to listen. You know, turn him around and just give him a shove in the back so he moves. And we get the car going at walking pace. We get it going at jogging pace. I'm looking over my shoulder. Where is my Rover, man? And there's no Rover. Now we're starting to get up to a minor sprint, and we're getting to the place where we were supposed to pick up and turn right and leave Brixton. And I'm looking over my shoulder for my Rover. We turn right. The roll starts to accelerate, and I'm starting to lose the race. I'm also starting to lose my president. And I'm breaking the golden rule of my trade, which is you don't lose your principal. And the number plate of the Rolls is getting small, like this. And we are sprinting down the road when I look over my shoulder one last time for my black Rover to come around the corner. And around the corner comes not my black Rover, but a clapped out, banged up old Renault 5. Dirty, off-white, cream-colored Renault 5 driven by a young girl from Brixton and her boyfriend. For the only time in my police career, I did what you see cops doing in movies, and we stopped that car. In the road, right there. We piled into the back. Who's we? Well, me, in the middle. Next to me on my right, a big Zulu from Pietermaritzburg called Spiwe Mkize. And on my left, a big front row forward who played rugby for the London Police, man. He's on my left, Frank Armstrong. I'm in the middle, and I've got these two big guys, and there's not a lot of room in the back of a two-door Renault 5. I say to this girl, follow that Rolls. You've heard that in a movie too, right? Thought so. You know what she said to me, fellas? What did that young lady say to me, guys? Come on, what do you think she said? Yeah, she didn't have the guts to say, get out of my car. She probably would have got a stiff crack around the ear. But she said, boys, I don't have enough petrol. Ladies, please, man, when that needle points to the E, it means empty, not enough. Actually, I shouldn't be so facetious, because in my home, it's my wife who always fills the car up when it's a quarter full, not me. I drive it until the needle is pointing to empty. So I've got nowhere to go, right? I can't tell her pull into the Shell garage over there, because by the time you get the nozzle out of the pump, the motorbikes have opened the intersection and the traffic's starting to flow across our route, and we've got no price. That Rolls is going to keep going all the way to Trafalgar Square, because that's where we're going. So I pulled the radio off my belt that the British police had given me. I called the cop in the car with my president. I said to him, "Stan, where's the nearest police station?" Because that's what we would do in South Africa. We have safe houses on our routes. They're normally police stations. And before Stan answers me, my driver tells me, "Kennington Police Station," she said. I said, "Well, how far is that?" She said, "It's half a mile up the road." I said, "Stan, please, tell that driver to turn into Kennington Police Station, because we need to find two motorcades, and you've got the wrong principal in the car." "Roger," he says, "we'll do that." And bless her cotton socks, my dear little driver, when that Rolls turned into the police station half a mile up the road, she was on the bumper. There were a few close calls, because we were kind of playing catch up and the motorbike cops opened the intersections and we had to wiggle through a few gaps there, but we got behind the Rolls. And as I stand here before you this morning, friends, I don't know whether I even remembered to say thank you to that young lady. She saved my career, man. And I also don't know how I got out of the back of a two-door Renault 5's seat, but it was very fast. And I ran into that police station and I said, "Where is the station commander?" And here he came, "Superintendent." I said, "Superintendent, I'm Superintendent Steyn from South Africa, and I've got President Mandela and Prince Charles behind me. You need to take them to your office and make them some tea, because we need to find two motorcades that we've lost in Brixton." So when this guy's jaw bounced off the floor, I thought I was talking to a fish, because he stood there like this. I said, "Superintendent, just make them tea. We'll find the motorcades. We'll sort this out." So they go into the police station. And Prince Charles, honestly, is as rattled as can be. He's in a flat spin. He thinks he is responsible for the diplomatic blunder of his entire life, and mummy is going to... "I'm never going to be king, man." So I actually said to him, I said, "Your Royal Highness, don't worry about it. The president doesn't mind this kind of diversion," which is absolutely the truth. Madiba loves that kind of thing. He says to me, "Really? Do you think so?" I said, "Well, look at him. There's Madiba." "Yes? How are you?" "So good to see you." He's greeting the whole police station, man. No problem. Loving it. So, of course, the station commander's office would be on the top floor, right? Right at the end of the passage. So we get them down there. A few minutes later, I get a call on the radio. "Okay, Rory, we've found the motorcades. Get them down here. Knock on the door, Mr. President. We can go now." "Oh, God. Still no tea." How difficult is it to get a cup of tea in London? Those poor pommies were so rattled that day that they couldn't make a cup of tea for the president and the prince while it took us to find two motorcades that we'd lost.
Rory, these are wonderful stories. I just want to take you back just to reflect upon what it was like working for this remarkable man and to see him in action as he offered forgiveness and reconciliation and brought races together and gave South Africa a real future. As someone who was following Jesus Christ and had the privilege of this wonderful job, as you think of the life of Nelson Mandela and the life of Jesus and the impact of both of them on your life, what would you like to say by way of concluding remarks?
It's a very good question, Dave. Because there were times that I reflected very deeply on the incredible privilege that I'd been given to serve this man. Please understand this morning, folks, that I do acknowledge and realize what a privilege this was. Who was I, after all? I was just a cop who happened to be in the right place at the right time, was given a job, and through a sequence of events that I had absolutely no control over, I get offered this incredible privilege of serving probably the greatest human leader of our generation. And I can stand here all day and tell you stories such as the one with the colonel as I saw him up close and personal change our nation. And you know, the whole point of this movie, Invictus, was the Rugby World Cup final of 1995, where he puts on that number 6 jersey and walks out of that stadium tunnel to greet the teams at the beginning of the match. And that whole crowd starts to chant his name. That crowd was 60,000 predominantly white people, majority of those Afrikaners, and they start to chant, "Nelson, Nelson." Go and get the video of that final and listen to that. It still gives me goosebumps today because I could not believe my ears. A simple act of putting on a rugby shirt that happened to have a number 6 on the back brought the entire Afrikaner nation, with a few, very few exceptions, brought them on side, and they were willing to give him a chance. So I can tell you stories like that all of the time. And as I reflect on that, what is so incredible to me is this, that I met Jesus Christ in 1982. I met Nelson Mandela in 1994, 12 years. So I often tell people that my life was changed twice. Now, as incredible a reconciler as Nelson Mandela is, I have to say to you this morning that that is infinitely less impressive than the reconciler that Jesus Christ is. Why do I say that, having had this wonderful privilege? Well, simply because South Africans, we are collectively holding our breath right now, because we don't know how much longer we have Madiba with us. He's 94 years old today. And one day we're going to get this awful news that he's gone. That will be, so I'm told by experts in the media, it will be the biggest media event in history, the funeral of Nelson Mandela. And the world will come to South Africa again. Your prime minister will come, and every living former prime minister will come. Every president and former president that were there during his term of office will come to attend that funeral. We are going to be so busy, we're not going to know where to turn. I don't know where we're going to find the people or the vehicles to do all the work, but we'll figure it out. And Nelson Mandela and David Mansfield and me and you, my friend, will, when we die, stand before the God who created us, and we'll have to give an account for how we've lived our lives. Doesn't matter who you are, president or pauper. On that day, it will be you and God alone. You can't get there with your spouse, your family, your churchmates, your workmates, your teammates, or anybody else. You will stand alone before God. And he will ask you one question. On what basis do you expect me to allow you to spend eternity with me? Now, I always say this. I say this with as much respect as I have in my fiber. That I don't care, my friend, whether you sitting here this morning believe that there is such a thing as eternity or not. Don't tell me that. It's like a kid in a class saying to his teacher, "Ma'am, I don't understand electricity." You know what? Walk to the wall, push the light switch, the lights will go off. Eternity exists, whether you believe it or not. And you will spend eternity either with God or without God. So when you stand before your Creator on that day, and I stand before my Creator, and he asks us that question one-to-one, it's not going to matter whether you're an Anglican, a Baptist, a Methodist, a Presbyterian, a happy clappy, a Catholic, or anything else. Because your church affiliation won't matter. The only thing that counts is, and the only answer that will answer the question satisfactorily, is if you can say to God, "Lord, on the basis that your son died for me 2,000 years ago, on that basis, I ask you to allow me to spend eternity with you in your new heaven and your new earth." Now, if you've never considered this matter of eternity deeply and fully enough, then I want to tell you this morning that that's the reason I've come to talk to you today. I didn't come here to tell you all these cool stories about Mandela. And they are great stories. And I can go on and on. But I wanted to come here today to tell you about the importance, the vital importance of eternity. Because Nelson Mandela changed me. But Jesus Christ changed me forever. So right into eternity, for the end of time, I am reconciled to my God who created me. And I want the same for you. And in a few minutes, I'm going to say a prayer. And I don't want you to put your hand up, run to the front, or do anything. But if what I've said about eternity has struck a chord with you today, then please pray this prayer with me. Only God knows and only you know where you stand on the matter of eternity. So would you please bow your heads with me now? And Heavenly Father, as every head is bowed and every eye closed today, I want to thank you, Jesus, for making a way back to the Father, making a way that lives up to the perfect holiness and the perfect justice of our great and wonderful God who created us. And that way back is through your blood and through your blood only. And so this morning I acknowledge to you, Lord Jesus, that I've been walking along the path of my life, following my own nose, captain of my own ship, and you've been going 180 degrees in the opposite direction. But right now, Lord Jesus, I'm making a U-turn. I'm going to walk beside you. I'm going to put my hand in yours, and I'm asking you today, Lord, come into my life. You take it over, and you run my life, and guide me back to our Father who created us so that we can spend eternity with him. I'm sorry for all of the stuff that I've had going on in my life and in my heart that has stood between us, and I confess today that you are the only one who can make that right. And I trust you, and I thank you. Amen.
Ladies and gentlemen, would you thank Rory Stark?